from the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean. Good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, psychics who assist law enforcement. Boy, I'm looking forward to that one. I've got to do this, by the way. Happy anniversary to my parents. Married today, 58 years. Dad is 84. Mom is, sorry, Mom, 78. She was rummaging through some papers today and called me up and said, I found the bill from the doctor when you were delivered back in 1950. $85. That's how much it cost to deliver me. It's pretty high, wasn't it? Well, here's some stories of the day. Illinois state health officials say they suspect a case of mad cow disease has killed a downstate woman who lived on a farm. The victim was from Logan County. Authorities say that it would be weeks before they know indeed if it turns out to be the human form of mad cow disease. Well, more problems with Chinese imports and exports. The safety problems affecting Chinese goods spread from toys to textiles to as many things as you can imagine. Now it hits New Zealand. Probably could affect us here, by the way. New Zealand said it would investigate allegations that imported children's clothes contain dangerous levels of formaldehyde. The government ordered the probe after scientists hired by a consumer watchdog program discovered formaldehyde in Chinese clothes at levels of up to 900 times regarded as safe. Manufacturers sometimes apply formaldehyde to clothes to prevent mildew, but it can cause skin rashes, irritation to the eyes, throat, and allergic reactions. A New Zealand retailer issued a recall at the weekend for children's pajamas made in China after two children were burned when their night clothes caught on fire. A U.S. military drill designed to enhance homeland security in the event of a nuclear attack occurs tomorrow through Friday in Portland. The exercise is part of the Noble Resolve program of the U.S. Joint Forces Command, and again, set for Tuesday through Friday in Portland, Oregon. Like other previous drills, it involves coordination with local officials in a model nuclear attack. The series of Noble Resolve experiments began April 23rd in Suffolk, Virginia. They represent a follow-up to a similar series of drills called Urban Resolve that took place in 2006. There are some people who are kind of skittish about this exercise. After pleading guilty to federal conspiracy charges involving an illegal dogfighting operation, quarterback Michael Vick is waiting to hear if he'll play professional football again. Vick's attorneys had hoped to hear back from the National Football League. They have not yet. It's unclear if a conversation ever happened between Vick's attorney and his client, who has agreed to enter a plea of guilty to charges and accept full responsibility for his actions. He now awaits sentencing. In Asheville, North Carolina, evangelist Billy Graham in fair condition, resting comfortably, not life-threatening. He's 88 years old. He has an intestinal bleeding situation. Egyptian archaeologists have found what they say could be the oldest human footprint in history in the country's western desert. According to Zahi Hawass, he says this could go back about 2 million years. The archaeologists found the footprint imprinted on mud and then hardened into rock while exploring a prehistoric site in a desert oasis. Severe flooding in the Midwest and southern parts have claimed now at least 20 lives after relentless thunderstorms dropped up to a foot of rain on parts of Minnesota and Wisconsin. Heavy rains over the tropical storm Erin also soaked Oklahoma and Texas. Hurricane Dean has strengthened into a monstrous Category 5 storm, and its first rain and winds began slamming the coasts of Mexico and Belize. Thousands of tourists are running all over the place to get away. Mexico's state oil company also said it is evacuating more than 14,000 offshore workers in the southern Gulf of Mexico. As a matter of fact, the mission cut short by Hurricane Dean, the space shuttle Endeavour getting ready to come home tomorrow. The hurricane, they say, no longer posed much of a threat now to the Houston home of Mission Control, but the managers did not want to take any chance and proceeded toward this Tuesday landing. Robert Zimmerman on the line with us now. He's the award-winning space historian. Robert, this decision, of course, to bring them back a day early, probably pretty smart, don't you think?
I would say so, but I also have to tell you, George, that 10, 15 years ago, I don't think they would have made quite the same decision. This is a case of NASA erring on the side of caution. I can understand their reasoning. The problem was that if Dean came into Texas and they were forced to evacuate Mission Control, they'd be coming in, they'd have to improvise Mission Control either out of Kennedy or at Edwards. And they have plans to do that. They have what are called disaster recovery plans to handle these kind of things, but they made the decision, we have the option to avoid that problem, let's avoid it. It's interesting, my wife is in disaster recovery, and she said to me that today, well, gee, you know, this is an opportunity to test your disaster recovery. If you don't test it, you don't know it'll work. And I can see her point in this. But I also understand where they're coming from, at least in shortening the mission to make sure. Right now, it doesn't matter. Dean isn't threatening Houston, so they have the option now to land tomorrow. And if they can't get it into Kennedy tomorrow, then they'll try again on Wednesday, and then they'll bring in Edwards and White Sands as backups at that point.
Of course, the other concern, Bob, of course, is the gouge in the belly.
Yes, 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 yes. Yeah. Well, you know, we talked last week, George. My thoughts were this was a great opportunity to test the repair technology
sure.
that they've been developing. And it had, to my mind, from what everything I've read, relatively little risk, to my mind, to try it out. They spent a long time arguing about it and discussing it with lots of engineers. And most of the engineers at NASA were in agreement, it appears, that they were better off not doing the repair. That the actual gouge itself is not life-threatening and probably will do minimal damage to Endeavour itself, so it won't delay later launches for Endeavour, while the repair would have been risky, carried risks. I'm still unconvinced, if you want to know, George. I don't quite understand why they wouldn't do this, teach themselves how to do it, and test its possibilities. The only argument I've seen so far, besides the fact that a spacewalk in itself does carry risks, though there's, you know...
Well, but they're doing them all the time.
Exactly. They've done thousands of hours of spacewalks have been done since the beginning of the space age, and actually there's been no injury or death of any kind. It doesn't mean it's not risky, but it carries, I think, relatively minimal risk based on today's technology and their experience. The only place they've mentioned the possibility of a risk is that they have really simulated the shape of the gouge as it is and know exactly, and I think this is a reasonable position, they know exactly how the wind and the heat is going to affect Endeavour when they come down with the shape of the gouge as it is. If they put the goo, the paint, and then the goo in it to repair it, they then create a shape that they haven't simulated, and they don't know how Endeavour will be affected by that. And so they don't want to, they say it's an unknown, so we'd rather not deal with that unknown if it's not essential, and we won't do it.
All right, well, we'll keep our fingers crossed, Bob Zimmerman, and hope all is well. Scheduled landing 12:30-ish in the afternoon Eastern time, right?
Yes, this 12:32 is the estimated time at Kennedy. And the way it always works is they try for a landing. If the crosswinds at Kennedy aren't that great, they'll hold it up for an orbit, and they'll try again an hour and a half later. And if they still don't like it, they'll cancel for the day and try the next day. That's the plan right now.
Okay, Bob, thank you very much. We'll check in now. We'll get the perspective of science advisor and head of the EnterpriseMission.com, Richard C. Hoagland, in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, thank you, Bob Zimmerman. Now let's get the other views and perspectives from our own Richard C. Hoagland, EnterpriseMission.com, with regards to the shuttle landing, the, of course, safety security measure to avoid Hurricane Dean as well. Hey, Richard, how are you?
Evening, George.
I'm
kind of torn on this one, and I must say that I echo, you know, Bob Zimmerman's curiosity, because here we have an agency that almost died when the Columbia crew died. I mean, every time you have a problem in space now, there is a political shadow behind all the decisions. Because if NASA does the wrong thing, and God help us, we lose another crew, we probably will close NASA down. There will be enough people saying, we just can't keep doing this way. You know, good people are dying, and they will close down the space program. So every decision carries a major political risk that you're not just endangering one specific group of human beings, the crew on the specific mission, but you're in fact endangering the entire future of the U.S. National Civilian Space Program. So I'm looking at this from a political perspective, and I was intrigued this afternoon at the last briefing that they held before they're going to bring them home tomorrow, right, to hear Wayne Hale, who was the shuttle program manager, say that they have not implemented these fixes to the tank, which is why this foam fell off this time and hit the underside of the orbiter, because it would delay flights to where they couldn't make the manifest schedule to complete the space station before the president's 2010 deadline to shut the entire shuttle program down.
Now, what do you mean by they haven't fixed anything? I thought after the Columbia disaster, they fixed everything.
No, they've done a whole bunch of fixes, but there's more to be done.
Oh.
And he said specifically, we don't have the resources, you know, to do it all at once. We have to do it one step at a time. So what happened to the to Endeavour was an incredibly low probability, they thought, event where ice and foam came off a bracket holding the liquid oxygen feed line that runs the whole length of the tank on the outside, covered with foam. It then fell in the airstream at about 300 feet per second, which is like 200 miles an hour.
Right.
It then bounced off a bracket that holds the shuttle, the orbiter, to the tank. If everybody in the audience put your left arm on the desk or in front of you, or just hold it up, and then take your right hand and put it up alongside, not touching, your upright arm. The left arm represents the tank and the boosters and the solid rocket boosters. Your hand represents the orbiter, the thing with the wings that the crew is in and goes up and comes back in. Well, this piece of foam, about the size of a grapefruit, we can see in the film, you know, came off, was whipped downstream in the 300 feet per second airflow at about a minute after launch as the shuttle is going up on all that energy into orbit, and it bounced off the strut and hit the tiles, something that they have admitted we never thought would happen.
Has happened.
What they thought would happen is that when the foam or the foam plus some ice hit the strut, it would shatter, you know, the chrysanthemum and the liquid nitrogen back where you were in physics, you know, in high school, and it would absolutely be harmless. But instead, like a cannonball, this thing bounced and hit the tiles at 300 feet per second, 200 miles an hour. Now, here's where I get very curious about their decision-making, because you were absolutely right. They have modeled and they have basically said, we're going to leave it alone because we understand its dimensions. We understand the airflow. We understand in the supercomputer simulations what the heating is. And they understand everything, right?
Well, we hope they do.
Wrong. There was an engineer last week from Lockheed Martin. Remember, I don't say anything on the show unless I can back it up.
I understand.
There was an engineer. If you go to you know, any of the NASA websites, you'll find out, you know, the minutes of the meeting, called the MMT, Mission Management, you know, meeting, who basically got his concerns, exactly the same concerns that I'm going to voice to you now, went all the way to the top of the chain, the command decision loop here. He said, look, we have only looked at this tile with cameras and lasers. No one has been out there to kind of wiggle them around.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
When you have a piece of something that's strong enough to resist smashing into a strut at 200 miles an hour and bounces into your tile, which is a fragile ceramic, he says, what damage is underneath that we don't know about, that we can't see, that we haven't tested for, which in the airstream coming back in at 17,500 miles an hour and 2,000-degree temperatures with the incredible aerodynamics and the airflow and the pressure. I mean, suppose the tile underneath the surface has cracks.
Well, and that's probably why he wanted it inspected, but he got overruled by almost every other group there, didn't
he? That's because they trust their computer modeling. Now, you know what computers do.
Well, but you got to feed the info into the computer.
It's called garbage in, garbage out.
Yeah.
No one has, I mean, his worst-case scenario is that what will happen is the Airstream would pop a couple tiles off. So instead of having a little crevice at the bottom down to the aluminum, you'd have 6 inches square, a couple of tiles are 6 by 6, that's 72 square inches suddenly exposed to the Airstream, and that would be catastrophic.
Yeah, that's 6 by 12. Now, let me ask you something. What is the most critical point for reentry for this situation, which, again, NASA says should not be a problem? And I don't want everybody to think we are jumping the gun here, but Richard is outlining possibilities.
Well, this came from an actual engineer who works with the tile system and whose concerns went all the way to the top of the chain.
So you think that individual tomorrow is going to be keeping his fingers crossed?
Absolutely.
And he's edgy?
I am too, because we don't know what happened underneath. In other words, the one thing NASA never did in its simulations, it didn't take a chunk of ice and fire it into the tiles point blank at 300 feet per second and see what happened. It took the visible damage to the existing underbelly of the shuttle.
I see.
Modeled that exquisitely, put that in the ArcJet facility, put that in the supercomputer Airstream models, but it never reproduced the entire accident. And that's where the question is.
All right, but once again, though, where's the danger point, and when are they out of the danger? When are they in the clear?
When they first enter the atmosphere over the Pacific, you know, after they do the retro burn, about a half an hour after that burn, that's when they develop maximum heating at 17,500 miles an hour for several minutes, like 10 minutes in that time frame. You are going to have incredible temperatures on the underbelly, which is supposed to be shielded by the tiles. And that's the part where I'm going to really cross my fingers, because we really don't know what the damage is under the visible surface, because that was never modeled.
And do, like the Apollo days, do we still lose voice communications for a little bit of time?
Yes, because you have this plasma blanket that surrounds the shuttle. So at that critical time, there is no communication. The radio waves can't penetrate the ion sheath. So you're basically in the dark until you hear the voice call, when the temperature drops low enough and the plasma clears, and they're basically then coasting, you know, free-falling through the upper atmosphere on their way to the landing. And that will be, you know, about 15 minutes of really no contact and cross your fingers. And I don't want to put a negative spin on this. I'm just saying that if it had been me, given what Bob just said about how we've done thousands and thousands and thousands of hours of spacewalks, I would have put a crew out there to start by jiggling the tile.
Yeah, you would at least tried something to set your own mind at ease.
Because you wouldn't know that they were loose. And then, of course, if they're that loose and they come loose, then you know you've got two other options. You stay at the space station. Remember, we're only going now to the space station, so it's a lifeboat. You keep the shuttle there. You bring up a repair kit that can really repair it. You launch the second spacecraft, the second shuttle, probably Discovery, what's called launch on need. You bring the crew home in the second spacecraft. You bring Endeavour home by remote control. It's outfitted for that. You don't risk the crew on basically what is a garbage-in, garbage-out computer scenario that had no real data other than camera footage and laser painting of the shape of that gout.
All right, fingers crossed. A little prayer won't hurt as well. EnterpriseMission.com. You also have a new website, sir?
Yes, we're launching our book tonight. The book on NASA, Dark Mission, The Secret History of NASA, has its own website, darkmission.net. Go there. We're going to update a whole bunch of cool pictures and stuff before the actual launch of the book in October. And, George, I will keep you apprised of that, because we have a major surprise in mind for where we're going to launch the book.
I know what it is. How about a phone number? Or is that everything's on the website?
No, I'm going to the Wisdom Festival to give a preview to a live group of people who show up. If you want to find me there, call the Wisdom Festival in San Francisco at area code 415-452-0369. That's 415-452-0369. For the insight into what NASA has done in the past and why they make these curious decisions about its future.
All right. Well, we'll all say a prayer, Richard.
We sure will.
See what happens tomorrow, 12:32 p.m. Eastern time, where the Endeavor scheduled to land, and I trust quite safely. Quite safely. In a moment, we're going to tell you about an event that occurred in 1974. What an event it was. The crash of two aircraft, one they say was not of this world. We'll be back. On August 25th, 1974, along the Rio Grande River near the Texas border town of Presidio, a thunderous explosion in the sky shattered the stillness of the warm summer night. An unidentified flying disc traveling at 2,000 miles an hour collided with a small airplane headed south from El Paso, Texas. The wreckage of both aircraft fell to the Mexican desert and immediately became the object of an intense recovery effort by military forces from both Mexico and the United States. We will be talking about Mexico's Roswell in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Two guests for you, of course, this hour to talk about the Mexico's Roswell. It's an incredible story. Ruben Uriarte and also Nuri Torres. They are the co-authors of this book. And Ruben, of course, has been a member of the Mutual UFO Network for more than 20 years, currently the state director for Northern California. Nuri holds a master's degree in library science from the University of Texas at Austin, also the author of Ghost Leagues and baseball's first Mexican-American star. We've got them both on the line with us. Ruben, how are you, first of all?
Oh, pretty good there, George.
Good. Nuri, you are with us?
Yeah, thank you very much for having me on tonight.
Oh, my pleasure. I look forward to seeing both of you at the Bay Area UFO Expo. I'll talk a little bit about that when you're ready to end the interview with me here this coming weekend. Should be a good time. Ruben, tell me, how did you get involved in this particular case, Mexico's Roswell?
Well, actually, it started when the History Channel had contacted me, thanks to Mr. John Schuessler, our former international MUFON director. They had contacted me because they were interested in doing a story about Mexico UFO sightings. And over the years, thanks through working with my friend Joyce Murphy through Beyond Boundaries, where we've taken tours to Mexico, we've developed a lot of great contacts. And what they were looking at was making connections. So later, they contacted me back and told me they were changing the whole focus. They were going into a series of Roswell-type crashes. And, of course, I was familiar with the Koyamik crash, and this was their focus.
Okay. And, Noe, your involvement in this one.
Yes, I was in the process of writing a book that I called Haunted Border, and it had to do with UFO sightings and other paranormal events that had happened here along the Rio Grande River, where I live close to Brownsville, Texas. And so I had this collection of events, one of which was the Koyamis story, which I had run across. And after linking up with Ruben, by virtue of having seen the program on the History Channel, then he and I began working on developing the story into a book.
It's an incredible story, of course, revealing the events of how two governments raced to the desert in Mexico to try to recover the evidence of this crash, this collision. Ruben, why don't you, beyond what I've just read, kind of set the stage for us. Tell us about what you believe happened.
Well, basically, this UFO was being tracked by U.S. Radar, and this object was coming towards the direction of South Texas until it diverted, and then it went right over the territory of Mexico. And at the same time, there was a plane that was leaving from El Paso. And as they were watching this object on U.S. radar, then all of a sudden it stopped. And later, that's, of course, when the next day the Mexican retrieval team went out to look for the plane, and then they found the disc. And with that, they went into their operations of not only removing their airplane and the disc, but they were also being under heavy surveillance by U.S. spy satellites and as well as reconnaissance aircraft. What happened, George, was that the Mexican convoy, stopped. And they saw these bodies laying on the ground, and what it did was that there was a retrieval team that flew out of Fort Bliss, out of El Paso, that flew their helicopters right over Candelaria, which is a close to Presidio, and then they landed and went ahead and retrieved the disc and brought it back to Fort Bliss. There's a lot of detail, of course, we have in our book, but what it did was it opened, as Noe and I were investigating this, and of course Noe is very familiar with this whole terrain out there in
right.
Texas. We found that there was a lot more evidence of other crash retrievals that we can go into later.
Now, when you say they saw bodies, what are we talking about? Human bodies or extraterrestrial?
Mexican soldiers that were in the convoy. And all this information, by the way, is based on the DENIP report. This was a report that anonymously was sent out to some investigators, Dr. Leonard Stringfield, for example, Elaine Douglas. They had received this report, this military report, which is strikingly, they were so the information in there, these people really knew the terrain, and this is where Noe really.
Well, I mean, but what kind of bodies did they find?
Oh, I'm sorry, human bodies, the dead soldiers. They did.
What do you mean the dead? How did we get dead soldiers?
Well, this is what gets really interesting, and what we're speculating is that perhaps these soldiers may have died from some sort of biological contamination,
or
virus.
Okay, you're saying that when they got to the scene, these Mexican soldiers, they were the ones that were found dead.
Yes.
How many?
Oh, we were calculating possibly about 24.
24 soldiers?
Yes. Or probably more. This is only, of course, this is what we're estimating, but we're trying to get more information with our contacts in Mexico with other investigators.
All right. Are there any reports, Noe, of occupants of this disc that was there?
There was a report that we received while we were preparing the book, while we were working on the book, from a longtime UFO investigator, Bob Dean. And he told us about a case where he ran across information about concerning a UFO crash along the Texas-Mexico border. And he thinks that the incident could be the one that's detailed in our book. He came forward and assisted us with information. And he had a photograph that a Mexican policeman, a former military policeman, gave him in Mexico City. The picture is that of a gray alien, a typical gray alien, apparently alive. And according to Bob Dean, this was an alien that was retrieved from a crash that occurred along the Texas-Mexico border. And Bob feels strongly that there could be a tie-in to the Coyame crash retrieval. So, therefore, we have a section in our book where we detail Bob's experiences, and we talk a little bit about his interview with a police officer in Mexico City and how he received this photograph.
Who was flying the small aircraft? What kind of plane was it that apparently collided with this UFO?
Now, this is an interesting story. The plane had taken off from El Paso International Airport at about 9:30 that evening. The crash occurred at about 10:30. The flight path, and talking to several pilots, the flight path that the small plane would follow on a flight from El Paso to Mexico City would absolutely take it over the area that's considered to be the crash site for this. So the details seem to pan out, as Ruben was saying, the mileage, the distances, the speed that the aircraft were traveling. All of these seem to add up and give us some very rich detail about this. The only thing that we haven't been able to uncover is exactly who was the pilot and possible occupants of the small plane.
Okay, all right.
It was a Mexican registered plane. It was registered in Mexico, and apparently there was some intervention on the part of U.S. intelligence after this event happened to basically blot out any evidence from logs and so forth. About the plane and its occupants.
How in the heck, Ruben or Noe, jump in here, how in the heck could an object, let's call it the UFO, collide with a small plane? How could this happen?
Well, that's a good question. But what we found later, and this is another case, About approximately 9 months later, George, there was a pilot by the name of Carlos de los Santos. And he was flying, he dropped off some businessmen. He was flying back to Mexico City. As he was driving his, flying his small plane, all of a sudden he felt like he was being watched. And when he looked over to his left, he saw a small disc that was right above his air.
And small being what, 6 feet?
Approximately about 12 to 15 feet in diameter,
okay,
is what he calculated. And there was another one on the other side of his airplane. And all of a sudden, he's looking forward to his cockpit, and it just came right underneath and slammed right under his airplane. And I have the actual recording of him calling "Mayday, Mayday, Mayday" to the air traffic controllers in Mexico.
Now, the wreckage during this crash, was it then the disc and the small plane, both of them, and what happened to the wreckage?
Yeah, this is a very interesting question. The wreckage, of course, fell there in an isolated part of the Chihuahuan Desert. We estimate, Ruben and I have been out to the area, and we spent about a week out there looking at where this is supposedly occurred. Anyway, the wreckage fell down to the desert below in a very isolated area. We did manage to find a gentleman who lived in that area in 1974. He has he tends cattle there, and he told us that he remembers one evening in 1974 when there was a series of explosions that he heard so loud that it rattled the windows in his small ranch house where he lives out there. After the debris fell down, rained down on the desert below, the recovery effort the following morning was mounted out of the big army base that Mexico has in Ojinaga, right across the border from Presidio, Texas. So the soldiers came along through one of the many desert paths that crisscrossed that area, and they came along with trucks and so forth to pick up the debris. And they had put all the debris into their convoy of trucks and were on their way back to the Ojinaga Army base, we feel, although that isn't mentioned in any of the evidence that we've looked at. But it stands to reason, because at that time, all the dispatches of military personnel were out of Ojinaga. So anyway, they were headed back to base when suddenly, apparently, something that they came into contact with, either biological or chemical, caused them to die. At that time, that's when the U.S. became involved, because of the satellite imagery that was being received from the Keyhole satellites at that time, and an aircraft that were dispatched to overfly the area. They saw the convoy stopped in the middle of the desert. They saw the Mexicans lying, a couple of the Mexicans lying outside their vehicles there in the middle of the desert. So the decision was made. The team was ready out of Fort Bliss, Texas, had been assembled earlier in the day, and it was ready to go to make the crash retrieval. And at that point, the U.S. came in with a big old cargo helicopter, a UH-1,
okay,
also known as
huge,
a Sea Stallion.
Yeah.
And they basically took over the wreckage from the stopped vehicles on the Mexican convoy. They attached a tow line from the Sea Stallion down to the, it's described as a silver disc about 16 inches in diameter. So they hooked up the tow line and took it away with the Sea Stallion. They were on the ground before they hooked it up and took it away less than half an hour, according to the timeline that we put together from various sources. So they went in and did this very rapidly. All the remaining debris, including the bodies of the Mexican soldiers, were all gathered together there at the site where the convoy had stopped. They were all gathered together, and the remaining operatives that were there to clean up this effort then, according to the Denob report, they exploded the remaining evidence, which were the fragments from the small plane, as well as the bodies of the dead soldiers from the Mexican recovery.
Amazing.
As part of apparently an attempt to disinfect the area due to the possible biological or chemical contamination that had occurred there that had caused the deaths of those soldiers.
Ruben Inouye, this story is wilder than Roswell. U.S. Roswell.
It definitely gets very, very interesting. One of the things that both Noe and I have been trying to do is through our connections with other investigators in Mexico, we've had a couple opportunities to be on the Spanish radio stations. And what we've asked is if anyone, any families are missing any particular loved ones from the past that were in the military, we would like to know. Good point.
Tell me about this very bizarre, mysterious pit in the middle of this charred earth during this collision. What do we know about this?
As part of our field investigation, George, Ruben and I spent some time, as I mentioned a while ago, in the desert, in the area that's known locally by the residents of Coyame and the surrounding areas as El Llano, which in English means the plain. And it's simply a very flat area that extends for about 100 miles north and south and about 20 miles east and west. And it runs right alongside a mountain range that basically separates the U.S. from Texas. There is this mountain range, and then there's the Rio Grande River, and then Texas is there. So anyway, this El Llano is this vast plain that stretches for about 100 miles, as I mentioned. And it was in there that we strongly feel that this was a crash site based on an analysis of the flight path of the small plane and the object. So it was here, without a doubt, that we feel that this incident happened.
Do we think that this craft might have been the same kind of craft that crashed at Roswell?
Well, with the Roswell crash, of course, there were bodies that were found. And as far as then the wreckage, this kind of particular craft that we're dealing with, that was outlined in the report there, George, it was a small craft. It was approximately around 16 feet in diameter. And in the report, of course, they say they didn't find any bodies. But again, we're finding some other clues.
Could this have been a drone, a U.S. drone, that just somehow crashed with a plane?
Well, that's another possibility. But we're putting together some in our field investigations, as I just mentioned earlier, about the Carlos de los Santos case, where he had three small discs that were surrounding his airplane. And then we were finding later that there were other discs that were also trailing other commercial airliners. So as we're getting into this case, we're just finding out so much more. And then the bottom line of this, George, is that there is some sort of cooperation between the United States and Mexico when it comes to crash retrievals. And this is what we've been and we found that there's five other cases of crash retrievals along the U.S.-Mexican border. And again, because of this connection and possible cover-up, and this is what we're hoping to find, or other documents probably from within Mexico that will show that there has been these collaborative efforts going. But I think we're on to something quite unique.
I think so. You're going to both unveil more of this story, of course, at the Bay Area UFO Expo. Those of you who are interested in going to this, I'll be out there on the weekend as well. www.thebayareaUFOExpo. In both Ruben and Noe's websites, Mexico's, make sure you put the S in there, mexicosroswell.com. For those people who can't get to this conference, Ruben, where do they get the book?
Well, they could definitely order it online there. We have through our website on Amazon.com, of course, and they could also order it through Barnes & Noble or Borders and a number of other outlets.
Well, it's an amazing piece of work. Let me ask you about the cover, the picture here that I'm seeing right underneath the headline titled Mexico's Roswell. Is that an animation picture, or is that a real picture taken by somebody of some event?
Well, Noe is the expert on that, but the background gives you an idea of what the El Llano looks like, that particular area there.
UFO is just like a sketch or a
exactly.
picture? Okay.
Yes, exactly.
The
Very
interesting
good.
Thing about that, George, if I can just pop in.
I've got 15 seconds for you. Go ahead.
It looks like we wanted the feel of the place, and we think that that's very close to where this.
Well, you did a good job. I'll see you both this weekend, okay?
Very good. Thank you.
We'll be back in a moment. Psychics who help law enforcement find people. It's an amazing story. That's next on Coast to Coast AM.